From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the Lansing State Journal calls on MSU President Simon to step down.
Forgive us if we don't take the MSU administration at its word when it says we're doing just fine. Because you see over the course of time that things have not been just fine in the recent past.
What it means for parents and students now that Marshall took over Albion Schools.
You're prepping our children for the system. I don't want to see my son in the system when he's older.
He's an automotive legend, but retired auto exec Robert Lutz argues the automotive era is ending and autonomous vehicles are coming.
In a way, it restricts some of the freedoms we've had up to now, but on the other hand, it opens up incredible new possibilities, and mainly, it's going to give everybody time back.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Marshall and Albion, two very different cities. But last year, Albion residents voted to have Marshall, a much whiter, wealthier district, take over their schools. I'm Cynthia Canty. We'll be exploring what all this has meant for kids and their families today on Undivided, a special Stateside series. But first, it's time for Luanna Simon to go. So says the Lansing State Journal. A front page editorial in Sunday's paper called on the Michigan State University president to resign over the way she's handled an array of sexual assault and harassment problems. The paper compares MSU's problems with Penn State's Jerry Sandusky scandal. Stephanie Angel is executive editor of the Lansing State Journal. Stephanie, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Why did the editorial board feel compelled to call for President Simon's resignation right now? What was the tipping point?
Well, I think we've been following the case very closely for, well, over a year now at least, about what's going on at Michigan State. Not specifically Dr. Larry Nassar, but that is part of it, but also the way the university has been handling their Title IX investigations and things like that. And we've called earlier for greater transparency and accountability. We haven't seen that. And as an editorial board, we looked. Dr. Nassar just pled guilty the last 2 weeks. He's going to be sentenced in federal court this week. It seems like an appropriate time to say, turn our attention to the university. Dr. Nassar said one of the reasons he was pleading guilty was so that the victims and the community could start to heal. The editorial board at the Lansing State Journal felt that healing won't be complete until there's new leadership at Michigan State University.
All right, let's talk about MSU's handling of Dr. Larry Nassar. And of course, that is the sports doctor who pleaded guilty now to a total of 10 counts criminal sexual conduct in two county courts. Also due to be sentenced later this week in federal court for three child pornography charges. We've seen more than 140 people coming forward, women coming forward, alleging abuse by the doctor. How would you characterize how President Simon has responded to the situation with Larry Nassar?
I think that President Simon has done everything by the book, particularly following the legal advice that she has received from counsel for the university and outside counsel. What the LSJ editorial board took issue with is just the lack of leadership in making the victims feel like they were heard, making the community feel like that MSU was pursuing this with urgency, dealing with the issues the alumni have. And there's a lot of concern about Michigan State and how they're handling this. And it doesn't appear to us that President Simon has stepped up to fill that void like you would expect the president of a university to do. As we've called for greater transparency, it would appear that the university continues to close its ranks, become more insular, and is not sharing that. Now, the university would say they're not able to be transparent because of whatever's going on legally, but the editorial board still felt strongly that there were things and are things that President Simon could be doing to put herself out there and the university out there in terms of letting the public know that they are taking the Nassar situation seriously.
Like what?
Well, if you look at the accountability that has been meted out so far at the university, you see that the gymnastics coach, Kathy Klagas, was... She retired a day after she was suspended for having a team meeting about Dr. Nassar. She was told previously of some girls came to her previously with concerns about him. So she retired. The only other person who has been held accountable besides Dr. Nassar then would be Dr. Brooke Lemon, who also retired from the university. She was the doctor who took some records from the doctor's office at the request of Nassar, then came forward and said that she had done so. But you look, there has been no other accountability that we are aware of. Now, there could be things happening we're not aware of, but without the transparency of the university coming forward and sharing those things, we don't know.
How much is MSU's ability to publicly respond being hindered by the legal situation? Meaning, what if they want to say more but just can't?
Well, I don't know that because I'm not a lawyer and I'm not privy to what they're doing. I mean, I'm sure there is some reason for playing things close to the vest on some forefronts. But I also believe that there are ways that conversations can happen and leadership and things that can happen that will allow the public to know that Michigan State is pursuing this with urgency. I think what was particularly telling yesterday was Rachel Denhollander, the first gymnast to come forward publicly and accuse Dr. Nasser, responded to our editorial and the MSU trustees' response to our editorial and said, Michigan State keeps talking about its legal liability and that there was no criminal wrongdoing that has been uncovered so far. But Rachel's point is there's more than just criminal accountability. I mean, it doesn't matter if people at the university are charged with a crime. There are still things that are happening over there that should not be happening, that should be addressed by the university and its administration.
If you just joined us mid-conversation, I'm talking with Stephanie Angel, executive editor of the Lansing State Journal, as we dig into the big front page editorial, yesterday's Lansing State Journal, Luana Simon must resign as Michigan State president. The editorial also points out it's not just the Nasser case that MSU has not handled well. How would you characterize, Stephanie, the way MSU has handled sexual assault on campus more generally during President Simon's tenure?
Well, we have done a lot of reporting on the Title IX issue at Michigan State University. The Department of Education did an investigation of the university. I believe it was of complaints from 2009 to 2014, and it was the Office of Civil Rights that did that investigation. And they found the way the university handles sexual assault to contribute to a sexually hostile environment at the university. I don't think anybody would say that's okay. I mean, the university is responsible for protecting the safety of all of its students, staff, and whatnot. And to have that declaration as being a sexually hostile environment is concerning. Now, we've done a lot of investigative reporting on the Title IX. We've reviewed a lot of the cases. We know some of them have been overturned at a higher level once the disciplinary board has ruled in favor of, let's say, an expulsion. Someone in Simon's administration who reviews those appeals has overturned, I believe it was a third of those over time. And so it's just concerning that it doesn't seem to be there's lots of issues raised both by victims and, quite frankly, the accused, that MSU is not taking these seriously.
Yeah. Meantime, the university says, hey, we've done a lot since that 2015 finding by the U.S. Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights. They say they've added investigators. They have sped up response times. They released a report last month that they say showed their Title IX policies are up to snuff with federal regulations and compare well with other Big Ten schools. What more should they be doing?
Well, policies are fine, and we don't know. I don't think we'll know until some time has lapsed how effective these new policies are. But again, you know, forgive us if we don't take the MSU administration at its word when it says we're doing just fine, because you see over the course of time that things have not been just fine in the recent past. And so we're not willing to take that. We want to see some more transparency. We want to know what's going on. I think there's just a lot more that has to come out about that. And quite frankly, the LSJ editorial board decided that that leadership needs to come from President Simon. She can address the public in certain ways to let us know that things are being addressed. And press releases and policy changes aren't going to cut it. I think that we are just looking for that strong leadership that lets the people of Greater Lansing, the students and the alumni, know that the university is very serious about what's happening there.
Stephanie, as you and the LSJ board crafted this big editorial, how did you weigh President Simon's accomplishments over her 12-year tenure, which are many, with what's happened on campus regarding sexual assault and harassment?
Sure. As you can imagine, this was a very difficult conversation to have amongst a board, because we have a lot of respect for President Simon. She's done great work since she's been at the university. And she's been there a long time, not just as president, but as provost, and before that as faculty. I mean, there is no doubt that President Simon loves Michigan State University and is committed to academic excellence. And we thought it very important in the editorial to outline some of the things that she has done as president, because she has had a strong presidency. I think her legacy, had it not been for what has transpired in recent years, would have been among the best presidencies in Michigan State's history. The positive work she's done, however, does not outweigh this situation. And it's a very serious situation with Dr. Nassar and then with other sexual assault Title IX things on campus, that we found in our conversation amongst ourselves that was such a significant failure and a lack of leadership that it requires her to move on and open that opportunity to move the university forward to a new president.
Is there anything that President Simon could do that you see could salvage her position?
Well, the Lansing State Journal is the only one calling for her resignation. So I think her, you know, you saw the trustees' response. They are very much in her camp. They are very solid with the work that she is doing. For the LSJ editorial board, I would say no. And we had that conversation as we were crafting the editorial and deciding our position. You know, a lot of time has passed with Dr. Nassar. It's been over a year with the sexual assaults. I mean, the investigation from the Department of Education was several years ago, but the cases dated back to 2009. There is a feeling amongst us that there's a deep culture at MSU, and it's not just President Simon. I mean, it goes up to President Simon because she's the leader of the university and ultimately responsible. But if you look at even her administration, in our editorial, we said whoever you place in as interim president should not be a member of her administration. We are calling for a cultural shift at MSU with President Simon being the person that must move on to help the university heal.
Stephanie, how have the readers of the Lansing State Journal responded to this editorial?
Well, as you can imagine, it has been widely read, both in print and online. You know, we're receiving comments right down the middle. There are people that have come out and praised us for it, asked what took us so long, are really willing, you know, wanting to see the university move forward and hold President Simon responsible for that. There are others who have said, you are, you know, dead wrong. How could you do this? Why is it on your front page? Please cancel my subscription. You know, President Simon has a lot of support in this community, as well deserved. I mean, again, she's been a good president, so I'm not surprised by the comments. I expected them to be pretty much down the middle, and we welcome them all. We've gotten them from all sorts of ways, and I suspect they will continue to come in. The story is still performing quite well for us online. So there are a lot of people who haven't even read it yet that I suspect will weigh in at some point.
Stephanie Angel is the executive editor of the Lansing State Journal. The paper on Sunday called for Michigan State University President Luana Simon to resign. Thank you for taking time to talk with us, Stephanie.
Thank you.
We offered the MSU administration and President Simon a chance to respond. We were referred to the Board of Trustees letter of support, which we will have posted at michiganradio.org. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Intuition.
Curiosity. The next idea.
There is no straight path from your seat today to where you are going. Don't try to draw that line. You will not just get it wrong. You will miss big opportunities.
It's fair to say the automobile has been central to the life of Bob Lutz. He's 85 now, but before he was semi-retired, he held top-tier positions at BMW, Ford, Chrysler, General Motors, where he was vice chairman. He recently wrote a piece for Automotive News with a striking headline, Kiss the Good Times Goodbye. It's about where the world of cars is headed, in his view, for better or for worse. Here in Michigan, the auto industry is both our historic legacy and an area of substantial innovation. So we thought, who better to have as our guest on The Next Idea? Joining us now to talk about the future or demise as cars as we know them is Bob Lutz. Pleasure to welcome you, Bob.
Yeah, good to be here. Thanks.
You begin your article with a sentence that really is striking. Here's what you write. It saddens me to say it, but we are approaching the end of the automotive era. That's a pretty major assertion. Why do you make that assertion?
Well, because the automobile has been with us for about 120 years, and it supplanted the previous prime mover, which was the horse. And we're now getting to the point where the automobile can't fulfill its primary purpose anymore, which is to move people from place to place on the surface of the earth easily and efficiently. It's not doing that anymore because we have so much traffic congestion that enormous amounts of time is being lost in all the major cities and urban agglomerations of the world in traffic, which is a great loss in national productivity. So the car is no longer able to fulfill its purpose. And then when you consider that the vast majority of cars are occupying space, like in the downtown area, in parking garages, underground garages, parking lots, they're not being driven, which adds to congestion, but it doesn't add to a transportation solution. It's perfectly obvious that something has to give, and what has to give is the use of privately owned cars initially, for the first decade or two in large urban zones. And the automobile as we know it may continue to exist for a while out in the country and, the vast hinterlands of Australia and the United States. But in high traffic areas, it's going to be replaced by autonomous modules, which you don't own, which you call up, they take you where you want to go, you drop it off, swipe your credit card, get billed, and the module goes off and serves somebody else. So all of the modules are in use 100% of the time. None of them are just sitting around taking up space.
How long do you think, Bob, it'll take before we're at that point, getting around in a fully autonomous module? What do you think will be the tipping point?
I think in the urban areas, it's probably 10 to 15 years away. And it'll be gradual. For a while, autonomous vehicles will coexist with human-driven cars. But that's not going to work real well. And there'll be a lot of accidents. I mean, no more than today. But the accidents that do occur will be caused by human-driven cars and not by autonomous cars. And at that point, governments around the world will say something to car owners like, look, by 20 so-and-so, we're not going to permit any privately owned vehicles in the inner city anymore. So you have 5 years to get rid of your car and start using an autonomous module. And getting rid of the car means either scrapping it or selling it to somebody who lives in an area way, way, way outside of town. Or if it's a valuable car, putting it in one of the automotive country clubs with racetracks where you can use it on weekends in a non-public highway situation.
Bob, we're a people that likes our personal liberties. Do you think people will sit still for being told, get rid of your individual vehicle?
Well, I mean, the government also requires driver's licenses. They require insurance. The government also says you can't drive on sidewalks or through parks. So, I mean, everybody accepts a certain role of government. And the freedom that we lose from being able to get into our car and go anywhere is only freedom up to a point, because the minute you get into a traffic jam, you ask yourself, why am I doing this? And traffic jams and stuff are going to be a thing of the past. So everybody's going to gain enormous amounts of time. Autonomous vehicles that are completely safe are a boon for the elderly, for the handicapped. If you want to send your kids someplace, you put them in an autonomous module and off they go. So in a way, it restricts some of the freedoms we've had up to now. But on the other hand, it opens up incredible new possibilities. And mainly, it's going to give everybody time back.
In your piece for Automotive News, Bob Lutz, you write about a blending that these modules of the future will be a blending of rail type with individual transportation. So basically, our transportation becoming more train-like.
Wherever you have a bunch of modules, they will group together to form almost like a train with minimum nose-to-tail separation, so that if you get to a controlled intersection, and by the way, these autonomous modules don't need red lights because they can detect a signal without a visible light. But when they stop to let the cross traffic through and then the signal changes to where your direction is free to go again, today the person in front of somebody goes. 3 seconds later, the next person says, oh, the car in front of me is gone, puts down his phone and gets going. And the next person requires 3 seconds and so forth. By the time you got to the 10th person, the signal has changed again. Well, with autonomous vehicles, it's not going to be like that. They're going to be linked together like in a pod, not physically linked, but electronically linked. So when the go signal comes, all of those pods are going to be accelerating at the same rate, maintaining the same nose-to-tail distance, and that whole string of autonomous vehicles will be through that intersection in about one quarter of the time that it takes human-driven vehicles because of human reaction times.
We're talking with automotive titan Bob Lutz as we explore his piece for Automotive News, Kiss the Good Times Goodbye. You know, Bob, when we talk about autonomous vehicles on this program, which is often, I will hear from people who email and go, not me, I wouldn't trust a self-driving car, I don't want one, they're being forced on us. MIT earlier this year found nearly half of people they surveyed say they would not buy an autonomous vehicle. How do you address that level of suspicion and mistrust?
Well, nobody's going to buy a vehicle anyway, so why worry?
Okay.
And people take autonomous vehicles all the time. You go to Detroit Airport and get on the Delta tram. That thing is moving at about 45 miles an hour in a narrow alley, and it never occurs to anybody that the thing doesn't have a driver. And yet it gets to the other end, it slows down, it opens its doors, probably transports tens of thousands of people a day, and it's fully autonomous. We used to have elevator operators. There was a kindly gentleman in uniform who stood in the elevator and had a handle in his right hand, and he'd wait till everybody was on board, then he'd close two doors, and then he'd move the handle up or down. And people said the same thing. I'm not going to get in an elevator where I just push a button and I don't know whether it's going to stop or not. So people get used to these things, and there is always resistance to change. People always say, oh, I'm not going to buy that. And then, of course, when they have no choice, they wind up using it like everybody else. So, but is this a huge change? Yes. Is it hard for people to get used to? Yes. We had the same thing when we still had horses. Hmm. People said, I'm not going to give up my horse. I'm not going to give up my carriage. With the horse, I know what I've got. Whereas with these horseless carriages, they break down. You've got to put liquid in them, et cetera, et cetera. So that doesn't trouble me at all. People complain a lot before the change comes. And when the change is forced on them, they're totally okay with it.
Bob, I'm wondering, is it hard for you, a man whose career has been so entwined with the personal car, the personal vehicle as we know it, is it hard for you to anticipate this change, or are you ready for it?
Well, I'm ready for it because by the time it comes, I'll be 100, and I'll be a good candidate for autonomous modules anyway. Just put me in it and enter the destination. It opens up whole new worlds. So many of my friends that are, you know, near my age, say they don't want to drive at night anymore. Well, with autonomous modules, not a problem. So, yeah, do I regret the demise of the privately owned automobile where brands matter and, you know, mine's got more horsepower and mine looks better and mine comes from Germany and so forth and all these non-transportation reasons that make cars fun to own and talk about? Yeah, that's sad. It's sad that it's going away. It'll be replaced by something else. Humanity won't suffer.
Bob, if this prediction of yours is true, what does it mean for Michigan? What would we have to do in Michigan to keep from having another decline of the Rust Belt moment in our future?
Well, first of all, even the most diehard critics of my article, most of the argument is simply with the timetable. Nobody doubts that it's coming true. I mean, nobody. Everybody in the automotive industry, supplier industry, government, insurance companies, everybody knows that this is coming for sure. But what does it mean for Michigan? It's not necessarily bad. I think the news is the worst for companies that make money on prestige brands like BMW, Mercedes, Audi, Porsche, Ferrari. These are brands which don't fulfill the transportation function any better than a three-year-old used Chevrolet Malibu. I mean, people dial up an Uber car, it arrives and they say, well, I'm not riding in a Camry or I'm not riding in a Maxima. I want an Uber where the guy owns an old BMW. I mean, that just doesn't happen. So the companies that rely on the prestige and the label are going to be in serious trouble when the modules become unbranded commodities, because these modules are going to be owned by the big transportation companies like Uber and Lyft and Maven and so forth. There'll probably be dozens of others. And they'll place orders for 50 or 60,000 modules at a time, which won't be branded Chevrolet or Ford. They'll be branded for the transportation company. So that does not necessarily spell death for Detroit as a manufacturing or engineering source, because these modules are going to evolve over time. The transportation companies are going to be more and more demanding in terms of what these modules can do, what the range is, what the cost is, and so forth. So it's going to require constant innovation, not to sell them one at a time to individual consumers, but to be able to win the bids when the big transportation companies place orders for 50,000 of these, 25,000 long ones, 30,000 extra long ones, and so forth. And as long as the Detroit companies remain competitive, and by the way, as long as the state government and the federal government continue to furnish a climate which makes it possible for manufacturing to thrive, and I frankly think the current administration is very much focused on that, I see no reason why the Detroit companies can't continue to exist. The only thing is they will no longer exist as Lincoln, Cadillac, Ford, Chevrolet, et cetera, et cetera. They will exist as American Module Manufacturing Corporation. Just like there are companies out there today, there's a company called American Freight Car Corporation. They build railroad cars for the railroads. And, you know, the average person's never heard of them, but they very efficiently build railroad cars. And that's kind of the way Detroit will be now. The supplier network, I think, has an excellent chance of surviving and doing really well as long as they maintain innovation and can produce competitively, which makes things really no different from today.
I was going to say, that's the way things are and have been. So you're saying keep on keeping on in that area.
Yeah, keep on keeping on. And it, in some ways, gets tougher because there won't be an added money to be gained from selling a GMC versus a Chevrolet. But the good news is all of the prestige brands that are taking a lot of business away from the mass producers, they're going to be in even worse trouble because they're going to have trouble producing modules competitively at the same low cost that, say, General Motors or Ford can do.
Bob Lutz, it was a pleasure to speak with you. We want to thank you so much for spending time with us.
Okay, you're quite welcome.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
When I moved from Tennessee to Michigan, winter hit me like a ton of bricks. Or maybe it was a full-body ice cream headache.
That's Tamar Charney, a friend of Stateside and former program director here at Michigan Radio. Tamar lives in Ann Arbor, but she works in Washington, D.C. And from time to time, she sends us her reflections on life in Michigan.
Remember how winters used to be really, really cold? One day you'd wake up and there was no doubt. Fall was gone. Winter had arrived. Suddenly, the wind rushed straight from the Arctic and smacked you in the face. Snow piled up around you and your eyes stung from the cold. But now it's kind of like an endless autumn until spring rolls around again. It's a bit damp, there's a touch of frost, sometimes there's a brief spell of cold and snow, and then it turns downright balmy. The last couple years, I've missed that clear delineation between fall and winter. But it dawned on me last week that I was missing some of the more subtle signs of winter's arrival. Like, oh right, it gets dark at 5:30, not 9:30. And my pets now have this crazy thick coat of fur, but there aren't any leaves left on the trees. And you know it's winter when you get in your sleek touring sedan and it feels like you're driving a monster truck, thanks to the ginormous snow tires that you still put on every year, despite the pathetic excuse for snowfall. Another sign in my life that winter's here is that my flight to D.C. now leaves the gate at 7:10 in the morning instead of 7:24 in order to make time for de-icing and still land by 9. Thanks, Delta, I really could have used that extra 14 minutes of sleep, but that's okay. But it's that nearly weekly jaunt to the East Coast that's made me appreciate even the toned-down season we still call winter. For one, we denizens of the Mitten State are a hearty lot. I noticed that as I walked to dinner with a friend in Washington, D.C. last week. She was wearing a winter coat, and I was wearing a sleeveless dress. I returned home the next day to even colder weather here. My neighbors were outside in shorts. You know what I'm talking about. Then there was that morning last year. I woke up before 5 to go to the airport. We'd gotten an unexpected dump of lake effect snow. I pulled on my boots, brushed the 6 inches of snow off my car, and drove down the snow-covered highways on the aforementioned humongous snow tires. My flight boarded, we got de-iced, and landed by 9 in D.C. I mentioned the snow to my coworkers. They stared at me in disbelief. How'd you get here? Didn't the airport shut down? I laughed. 6 inches is nothing. You leave a few minutes early, whatever. But later on, I remembered my very first Michigan snowfall. I woke up and looked out my dorm room window to see the campus had turned all white. There must have been at least 4 inches. Yeah, 4 inches. I was elated. Classes would be canceled. I could go sledding. I could play in the arb. Until the kids in my hall looked at me like I was from Mars. We don't get snow days. Plus, it's only 4 inches. This is nothing. I had to quickly study up on winter Michigan style. So while we still have ways of telling the subtle difference between fall and winter these past few years, our real winters were something unique to our northern climate. I know we all complained about the snow and the cold. I know we spent all winter longing for those long summer days. But I secretly hope our harsh winters will return. It's just that it's part of who we are, or who we become, if we take enough turns around the elusive Michigan sun. So I say, bring on the cold temperatures, and let's crank up that Lake Michigan snow machine.
Tamar Charney is the managing editor for NPR One. Still to come, Undivided, a special stateside series exploring just what the Albion-Marshall school merger has meant for kids and their families. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The past few years have brought change after change for students in Albion. For years, they saw friends and neighbors hop on buses from other districts every morning. School after school closed. The number of students kept shrinking. And last year, residents of Albion voted to have Marshall Public Schools take over their district. So what has this meant for students and families who live in Albion? Michigan Radio's April Van Buren is trying to answer that question over the next few days in Undivided, a special three-part series.
Mornings start early at Wanda Kemp's house. It's 5:45, and she is already in the kitchen working on tonight's dinner. There's a crock pot on the counter with black-eyed peas that have been simmering all night. An alarm is going off in the room where her two kids are sleeping.
And I think my first one just hit the floor.
Her 8-year-old son, Zaire, comes out first.
Oh, different first one. Good morning.
And then her 14-year-old daughter, Zariah.
That's the one I was expecting.
Good morning, Zariah.
As his sister gets ready for school, Zaire crawls back into bed and turns on the TV. He switches the channel to Nickelodeon. It is one of his favorite shows, Henry Danger.
It's about this little boy being the super psychic.
As you might imagine, a kid who has psychic superpowers is a lot more interesting than a reporter's questions, especially when it's 6 a.m. and you're 8 years old. Zaire doesn't have to be at school for almost 3 hours, and he isn't really a morning person, but he gets up early every day so he can ride with his sister to her bus stop. The street lights are still on when Wanda pulls her black SUV out of the garage. The kids are quiet and sleepy in the back seat. Zaire is still in his plaid pajama pants. Wanda drives a couple minutes down the road. She pulls up to the bus stop and puts the car in park. They have a few minutes to wait before the bus shows up at 6:15. The whole family folds their hands and closes their eyes, and 14-year-old Zariah starts to pray.
Thank you for all the things that you're going to do for us today.
Zariah asks for her mom to get through the workday. She asks God to keep her mind open to learning and to keep her and her little brother safe. 5 years ago, Zariah could have rolled out of bed and walked to school in less than 10 minutes. You can actually see the old Albion High School from her front yard. But now, she goes to Marshall High School, a 45-minute bus ride away.
God, I ask that as we enter the school doors, you will open our minds up and you will let us be able to go in there and prove to everybody that we are smarter than most people think we are. In the name of Jesus, amen.
I'm April Van Buren, and this is Undivided, a special series from Michigan Radio. In Michigan and across the country, school districts are becoming more segregated, both by race and income. That makes Albion and Marshall's story unique. Students in Albion used to attend an almost entirely low-income, majority African-American district. But last year, Albion residents voted to have Marshall annex, or take over, their schools. Now middle and high school students get bused into Marshall. It's a mostly white, middle-class city about 13 miles down the highway. A lot of education researchers will tell you, when kids go to an integrated school, everyone benefits. But parents in Albion were promised they'd still have a school in their city after annexation. That school is Harrington Elementary, where Zaire is in third grade. There are no buses that shuttle the district's youngest students from Marshall to Albion, which means Harrington remains a school with students who are mostly kids of color and who are almost entirely low income. For those students, the first year as part of Marshall Public Schools was not an easy adjustment. The students at Harrington Elementary are happy to tell you what they love about their school. Recess comes up a lot, and so does lunch.
Hello, world. My name is Ty, and I am 11 years old.
For Ty Walker, it's getting to be a helper.
I am in fifth grade, and I help little kids like the second graders, so that's why I'm out here right now with second graders. And whatever we do is usually a lot of fun.
Ty says he likes feeling like a role model. But there is one thing Ty doesn't like about his school.
That people fight.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they yell at each other, they physically fight.
Mm-hmm. Like,
he punches his fists together. Ty wasn't the only student who told me fighting and bullying were problems at Harrington last year. Plenty of parents I talked to felt that way, too. But many also had serious concerns about the way the school dealt with students who were acting up, including Zaire's mom, Wanda Kemp.
At the age of kindergarten through third grade, what is children doing that bad that you're kicking them out of school, that they're being suspended and sent home from school?
There were a lot of students being sent home. Harrington Elementary had a little over 260 students last year. It had more than 160 out-of-school suspensions. Let me repeat that. More than 160 suspensions in an elementary school with 260 students. That is much higher than Marshall's other three elementary schools. Wanda's son, Zaire, racked up so many suspensions, she started getting letters from the state.
And I would get letters telling me, oh, your son has missed so many days out of school.
They said she could face truancy charges for Zaire's absences. So Kemp called the principal at Harrington.
And I said, look, do not send another letter to my house talking about how many days my son has missed out of school. When he's missing days because I'm not sending him, I will accept that. But because you're sending him home, do not send me another letter telling me how many days he has missed out of school.
At home, Zaire is a smiley and energetic 8-year-old. He likes reading. Right now, it's the Diary of a Wimpy Kid series. His favorite food is McDonald's.
Cheeseburger and fries.
What Zaire really loves, though, is basketball. He spends recess on the basketball court at school. And when he's at home, he plays NBA video games with his 4-year-old nephew, Zachariah.
I'm not playing defense.
You can play offense.
Oh, yeah. Kyrie sucks.
But when I asked Zaire what his favorite thing about school was last year, this is how he answers.
Really not.
He says getting sent home all the time made him mad.
Because I felt like I got in trouble by other kids.
Zaire, like around two-thirds of the kids at his school, is Black. And there are lots of data that show school discipline has a disproportionate impact on kids of color. Black students are nearly four times more likely than white peers to get suspended. They're twice as likely to be expelled. That context wasn't lost on Wanda Kemp. She remembers reading an Ebony article about the so-called discipline gap.
And they were just saying how the way they suspend the kids, K through third, I think she had said, is setting them up for failure. You're prepping our children for the system. I don't want to see my son in the system when he's older.
During the 2013 school year, Albion Public Schools suspended 17 kids. That's across the entire district, kindergarten all the way through eighth grade. Now, compare that to last year at Harrington, which again had 160 out-of-school suspensions. So, what changed? Wanda Kemp says it comes down to one thing: relationships.
Are you taking the time to establish a relationship and get to know a person? Because a person can have a bad day, a bad week, can even have a bad month. But does that mean that's that person?
Around half of the teachers from Albion were rehired to work at Harrington last fall. Third grade teacher Deb Seeley was one of them. She's been teaching in Albion for more than 20 years. And she told me when Marshall took over, there were some really big improvements. In the final year of Albion Public Schools, Seeley had a class of 32 students and was all on her own. Last year at Harrington, she got part-time support from a classroom aide.
And I only have 21 students. So it's just wonderful.
But Seeley told me it was still a rough adjustment. They weren't fully staffed when Harrington opened. Four teachers left after the school year started. The district struggled to find long-term substitutes.
And I don't think the administration understood how much support we need with our kids that are at risk. And it's been kind of an upstream, uphill battle trying to get things in place.
Teachers weren't the only ones who were frustrated with the way things were going.
It's just this year, I feel like it's just been changes after changes. And until we get a study staff the kids are used to, then it's not going to get better. We need to have a study staff on hand here.
That's Katie Burton. Her daughter Layla was just finishing up third grade when we talked at a school picnic last June. Burton says all these changes in staff created a toxic culture at the school.
Bullying is very, very bad at this school.
When she tried to address it with administration, she got a lackluster response. Burton told me she is happy Layla can go to her neighborhood school. But she also said things have to be better at Harrington this year. Randy Davis says they will be.
There's a commitment of moving forward in a new way, with new philosophies, with really great support.
Davis is superintendent of Marshall Public Schools, and he says he understands the frustration about school culture last year.
If parents were feeling stressed out about that, I'd say, I'm with you. I was stressed out about it.
And Davis acknowledges there were, in his words, a grossly disproportionate number of suspensions. He says that is not the kind of school he wants Harrington to be.
Out-of-school suspensions for elementary students don't do an awful lot of good. You know, the idea is how do you keep them in the buildings and teach them how to relate to each other, engage with each other.
Davis says Marshall is committed to doing things differently. Which is why in May, with less than a month of school left, Davis fired Harrington's principal and brought in Dave Turner to steady the ship.
Well, candidly, it was a little crazy. A lot of systems were not necessarily in place, structures. If this happens, how do we handle that?
Turner was the principal at Marshall Middle School. And more than one person told me, he is exactly the kind of person you want in charge of a transition like this one. Turner told me he understood why kids at Harrington were having a tough time.
You have some students that have had three teachers this year. Well, you look at me. Here I am. 17 days or 14 days so far in this building, and I'm new to them.
Those constant changes made it hard for kids to build relationships with the staff. And when kids don't trust or feel connected to someone, they're more likely to act out. But Turner said, it's not like that is an impossible problem to solve.
It's not rocket science. We just have to focus on behaviors and relationships, and I think we'll be okay.
Turner didn't have a lot of time, but he managed to make some real changes. He rearranged lunch and recess schedules to have more adults on hand. When teachers needed help with a student, Turner was there.
I told teachers, look, here's my number. Text me, call me if you need me.
He greeted kids as they got off the bus. He joked around with them. And Turner made himself available to parents, too.
We have to find a way to support those parents that need the help, too, because I'm finding that the kids that are in trauma or the kids that are struggling, the parents are in some way struggling, too.
When Turner took over, suspensions went way down. In the first 16 days of May, there were 30 out-of-school suspensions at Harrington. In the last few weeks of school, after Turner took over, there were just 5. A lot of parents I talked to felt encouraged by the way the year ended. But this year, there are more changes in store for Harrington families. Dave Turner, the one who made all those changes, he is back at the middle school. And Harrington, again, has a new principal. His name is Robert Giles, and it's up to him to convince people the school can turn it around.
I have to have these babies learn me. Trust me. Have some confidence in me. Love me.
This year, Harrington has a new leader. It has a new approach to discipline and more teacher training and family supports.
And I think that their parents, once they see a more inclusive environment, a more cooperative environment, even if they hate the annexation, they'll see a benefit of what's going on with their children here.
Ultimately, Marshall Public Schools has the same challenge Albion did. Convince parents to keep their kids in the local school. Parents like Katie Burton, who says if this year isn't different, she'll be looking for another district for her daughter.
I'm going to give it again a half a year until open enrollment, and if everything's fine by then she'll stay here.
Marshall needs Burton and parents like her to choose their neighborhood school. Because if Harrington loses too many students, eventually, there might not be a neighborhood school left to choose. I'm April Van Buren, and this is Undivided from Michigan Radio.
The Marshall School District is making some big changes and big promises this year, and we will get to what those are later in this series. But first, 15 years ago, Albion schools had more than 1,800 K-12 students. Now it has fewer than 250 kids in one elementary school run by another district. So how did this happen?
We talk about Inkster, who's not here now. We talk about Buena Vista. They're not here. I was determined not to let Albion be the third minority district in this state that just fell off the face of the earth.
Tune in tomorrow for part two of Undivided, a special stateside series right here on Michigan Radio. Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings and engineered by Bob Scon. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Danny Henzel, Sarah Leeson, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.